This podcast is brought to you with limited interruption by Rudy Luther Toyota. Whether looking for an exciting brand new Toyota, a certified pre-owned vehicle, or getting quality routine maintenance and service for your vehicle, Rudy Luther Toyota is the place to go. Rudy Luther Toyota, the southeast corner of 394 and 169 in Golden Valley. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show for your Tuesday. Matt and Patrick here today. No Brett Johnson. Usually Brett is joining us on Tuesdays and Fridays doing an interview. Unfortunately, he is, well, not fortunately for him, he's having a great time. He's on vacation for the next few days. So it's you and me, Patrick, taking this into the holidays. How are you, my friend?
Doing good. So if anything gets screwed up or we go off air, you guys can all blame me.
We already do.
Oh, shots fired.
That's kind of standard operating procedure around here. We actually have it in a manual. Let me see if I can find it here. Oh, no, never mind. It's just blame Patrick. Patrick did it. What? Patrick!
In the procedures book, if you just open it up, if something goes wrong, it just says in size.
Picture of Patrick right there. Ta-da! All right. I think we've solved that problem. Here's good news is, though, we're chock full of interviews today. Rebecca Cook, she is running to be the Democrat to try to hold on to the Wisconsin 3 seat. Dude, have you ever seen the Wisconsin 3 district? You want to see how gerrymandered the Wisconsin Republicans have made everything over there? Pull up a map of Wisconsin 3. It's like a reverse Y. It makes no sense. It goes basically from it's right across the river here. Kind of on the south of 94 and the county over that way, all the way down to the southern border with Illinois. But then for some weird reason, it shoots up another spur to kind of go and take a bunch of cities just that are kind of – there are cities like in between portions of Wisconsin 3. It is bizarre.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now. That is a weird district.
That's gerrymandered. And by the way, I want to make sure we all remember every Republican in the 1990s screaming about gerrymandered districts. I'd never do that. Lying sacks of crap. That's all you guys are. That's all you guys are. You guys out. Remember that? I remember that. All you guys, the Tom DeLays and all you guys were all screaming about, you gerrymandered these districts. And look what you guys have turned it into a freaking master's class. Dear Lord. Anyway, Rebecca Cook is going to join us. She's running for the Democratic nomination, and that'll be about 4:30. 5:05, Dina Winter, the exceptional Dina Winter, is going to join us from the Minnesota Reformer. She's covering the Potter trial. We're going to get the latest on that, and especially okay, clearly she should have known she did not have her taser in her hand. My God, did you see we'll get into that. We'll get into that. So, Patrick here today, I had a funny thing happen, and this does happen over the holidays sometimes. A family friend, an old family friend of mine, when I was a kid, when I was born in Minnesota at a young age, I moved to Rhode Island, and I lived out in Rhode Island for a long time, and we had good friends named the Meekers, and I was single digits back then. I mean, this is back in the 70s. And, you know, we would go and hang out with them. And there was in one of them was a guy named Matt Meeker, and I was friends with him and he was friends with me, and we kind of hung out. So I haven't seen this kid since we moved. I think he came up and our family came to our cabin once when I was like 12. I think that was the last time I saw him. So I call up my mom. My mom's birthday was yesterday. I call up my mom, say happy birthday. And she puts this person on the phone who, once again, the last time I saw them was 12. So there was this, hey, you, how are you doing? Great to see you. What have you been up to? All right, no hints there. No hints there. No hints there. I have to admit, I did pretty well. I narrowed it down to one of two people, a kid that used to live in our block on Cindy Ann Avenue in East Greenwich, Rhode Island, or it was Meeker. And I had a 50-50 chance. I almost was pulled it off. Have you ever had that happen, just a family get together? Hey, guess who it is? Oh, hi, you. Good to see you.
That happens at every family gathering I go to. Like, hey, Patrick. And I'm like, who am I talking to?
I've gotten to it. My family's big. I'm the youngest of seven. We've got an extended family, to say the least. And once again, my great-grandfather was the one who, you know, kind of started our cabin up north. So basically the ownership now is second cousins. And so I've got this huge family. And I kind of figured out a way to get around that to a point. It's just like, which family members are you? You know, you're from the, you know, you're from the Adams side of the family, or you're from Moeller side of the family. Okay, great. I can figure this out. But yeah, it's rare when it's like, mom's like, he hasn't changed at all. Mom, he's 50 something. The last time I saw him was 12. Yeah, he's changed a little bit. He looks the same. He might look the same to you because, you know, as an adult and you look at seeing the kids grow up, they say haven't changed. I can see that now with my own kids. I mean, I look at my son and I say, oh, yeah, he hasn't changed at all. Or I see one of his friends, oh, he hasn't changed at all. I get that. But from my perspective on a friend that was 12 when I was 12, no clue. Not a clue. Happy holidays, everyone out there. This is why there are sales at liquor stores. 952-946-6205. I got to bring up, I'm outraged. Patrick, I am outraged to begin this show because of theft, thievery, shenanigans, courtesy of those people in North Dakota. Do you know what they have done? Do you know what they have done?
I'm excited to find out.
They stole one of our snowplow names.
Uh-oh.
They stole one of our snowplow names. North Dakota following a frosty footsteps of its wildly popular and much more in with it Minnesota. Neighbors have revealed the winners of their first ever Name a Plow contest. The North Dakota Department of Transportation took suggestions from the public last month, then had employees whittle down the list to 8 winners. The agency revealed the selected names on Tuesday. There are some here that are new, which I have not. Blizzard Wizard, all right. Yeah, kind of weak. Plowasaurus Rex, okay, getting better there, all right. The Below Zero Hero. Now, yeah, that's not bad. Storm and Norman. Truck Norris. Come on, Republicans. Orange Thunder. Plowzilla. Okay, most of those are weak. I'm Below Zero Heroes there, but for the Bismarck District, the name they have chosen is Darth Blader, and I believe Darth Blader was one of our plows.
I think that was the one that I really liked. I know you really liked Baby Got Back.
Got Back was brilliant, man. I said, if you have that, you got to play the Sir Mix-a-Lot song every time you're out in the road, loud through speakers outside so everyone knows where you are. So it's like you can just see some guy like in a field and off in the distance here. You know what the heck is? It's Baby Got Back, man. They took Darth Blader, North Dakota. Hey, I should expect this from a state that basically stole their name from South Dakota. Original, guys. How dare you? Blader was ours. I'm like, why am I, like we're Sith Lords controlling a dark force plow. Hey, he was our guy. He was working with us. They're going to all be too. He was Minnesota. Oh, are you going to start a comic strip over there called Cashew Nuts now? What are you going to do, huh? Is that what you're going to do? You're gonna get a hockey team, named them the Wold? What are you going to do? Come on. Copycats. Come on. You should have cable by now. You should have, go to a library, look at a book, for goodness sakes. Inspire yourself that way. Well, maybe not. That's all we need to get into the snowplow naming contest is literary guy. Oh, gosh. Well, I found this wonderful book from the 1880s. Oh, my God, no. No. It's a whimsical character. You're going to love this. He's a gnome, but we're going to call him a snome. Oh, no, no, just no, no, stop. No, no, I don't need to hear a poem. Stop. I don't need it. No, stop. I don't need to hear a poem. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. You got to do better, Wisconsin. Well, North Dakota. I got to figure out what state I'm targeting. At this point, it could be a thing. Don't tell Rebecca Cook I took a shot at Wisconsin. If she gets into Packer stuff, no. We're not going to do that.
We're shutting the show down happens.
We're walking, just silent. We're gonna leave this show with an hour of silence just so you can think about what you've done. 952-946-6201. It wouldn't really be that bad, would it, actually? I mean, I've heard this show. Let's go with the silence. An update on two stories we had yesterday. And at the end of the show yesterday, I brought out left-wing guy that did something stupid, or in this case, left-wing woman who did something stupid, and right-wingos that did something stupid, too. And I can easily do that. We can be critical. And the thing is, I get tired of when I see stuff that is bad. You know, that you basically, I mean, hey, I ain't a Bob Kroll either, but when you guys got people up rolling up to their house up in the North Metro and you know, screaming what they're doing, that's a little bit, you know, rough. I don't have any problem with public protests on public property. I have a much bigger problem than police, like with Potter's house, you know, basically quarantined a zone around it because, hey, if other people are convicted or accused of murder, do you give that same benefit to them? No, of course not. That was just, you know, that was over the top. I don't believe in protecting these people to a point where people can't protest them. But at the same time, you can't be as aggressive, would probably be the right term, as the protests were up there. I mean, you got to be able to point out when people do bad things, period. And it's not a right thing or a left thing. It's just a bad thing. It's one of the problems we have right now in this country where you have insurrectionists who try to overthrow the democracy of the United States. And they're downplayed as, oh, that's nothing. I mean, heck, half of Fox News's staff seem to have been involved in some way in this whole thing. And their whole point is, we're just not going to talk about it. I wonder if the one guy that left Fox News this weekend, Chris, what's his last name? Do you remember?
Chris Wallace. Oh,
thank you, Chris Wallace. I wonder if Chris Wallace, the reason why he left is he found out that his own coworkers were basically knew exactly what had happened and been lying to everyone all the time. Anyway, I think it's an important thing. You have to be able to criticize people on both sides. I'll criticize the person on the left again here. An elderly couple in Blaine is now on the receiving end of an outpouring of support after an Instacart driver allegedly dropped their groceries on the ground, purposely drove over them, and left a derogatory note behind. Amber Gray this week started a GoFundMe hopes of raising $500 to help the two family relatives. I believe right now they have given $7,900, so they're going to be fine. They're going to be fine. I don't think they're going to necessarily be living, wondering where their next meal is going to be coming from. So that's good. We never dreamed we could have such an incredible response to our story. Gray wrote in the update, "We cannot begin to express how grateful we are. Started this fundraiser as a way to raise money for groceries. Has become so much bigger." Well, If you try to make it a situation where, once again, all police officers are angels, not so much. You can't do that. Nor can you say all liberals are horrible. No, I'm not going to let you do that either. But this person shouldn't have done that. Blaine police have identified the 36-year-old woman from Coon Rapids, said that charges are likely soon. And they should probably be. I mean, at the same time, it probably should be. So, there's the update on that. The elderly couple's fine. And the individual who was belligerent beyond belligerent in their response, they themselves, you know, have been reprimanded. I'll get to the other story here in a second, but let me tell you what, before we get into the break here, let's get Stan from Minnetonka on in, wanted to chime in about Kim Potter. Stan, welcome on in.
Hey, I just wanted to ask if anybody has ever seen a demonstration of a taser where somebody has like stuck it into somebody's ribs, like Lee Harvey Oswald style. I mean, when people shoot a taser, they're usually 6 or 8 feet away. Otherwise, they light up like a Christmas tree themselves, you know?
Well, you were right. There's a reason why you're supposed to discharge those from a distance. And in Potter's case, if she would have had the taser, which she didn't, she had a gun, she would have probably been the right distance, or, you know, it was like 4 feet from there, which I think is minimum distance. But she would probably wouldn't herself not have gotten shocked. She could have shocked her own partner, though, who is what they're trying to use as her defense. I mean, that is there. But no, you don't want to be right next to the person when you shock them because of exactly what you said. Electricity is a very uncontrollable thing, and it can, you know, you can be too close to it and you can shock yourself.
And the other thing is, like, the what you're shooting, the projectile has all these wires hooked to it, so it's not going to go in a straight line. It's more likely going to, you know, hit something else on the way there, like her partner or whatever.
Stan, thank you very much. There is a question of whether she should have even attempted that. Once again, their whole defense is if he would have gotten in the back of the car, if he would have taken off, if he would have been stuck on the vehicle, if he got injured on that case, then it was justified. No, it's not. You're trying hard to justify this after the fact. The reality is there's no way on the planet a experienced officer should have pulled their service weapon as opposed to it and thought it was a taser. There's no way on the planet she did that intentionally. And I'll do it the same thing. If she would have pulled her taser, she might have shocked her own partner, but they probably, both her partner and Dante Wright would probably be alive. And the disturbing testimony yesterday of how lethal her shot was through the heart. There's no way he was going to survive that. There was no way. 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. I'll give you an update on the groveling teacher story from South Dakota. South Dakota, not you again. We'll talk about that. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. Going back to the plow story. Someone making the point, wasn't Lawrence Welk from North Dakota? How about Polka Plow? That's not bad. How about you just call one Bubbles in memory of Lawrence Welk? Bubbles would be a fantastic plow name.
That's funny because I was thinking about the Lawrence Welk connection. I'm like, they should have named a plow after him or connect, but I don't know enough about him to make a joke like that.
Thank you. Well, the grandmother I had lived well past 100. When I'd go visit her, there was two things she watched every weekend when they were playing. It was the Vikings and then, Lawrence Welk. Holy cow, did she love her Lawrence Welk. Just loved it. And that was must viewing for her. So there you go. I mean, John, is it Josh Duhamel is also from North Dakota? You could maybe, Plow Duhamel? Well, that sounds actually naughty, so we better not do that one. 952-946-6205. After the insane outcry of the other story, what was I saying? You got to be able to get mad at people on the left. And I'll tell you what, there are a lot of rightos who are like, I don't see what the big problem was in South Dakota. Dude, that was a problem. The organizers of a mid-game promotion that involved teachers scrambling for $1 bills to help fund classroom purchases have apologized following a national uproar. A wave of criticism swept over the Sioux Falls Stampede after a video of Saturday's Dash for Cash event went viral. In the clip shared by Sioux Falls Argus Leader reporter Annie Todd, 10 teachers can be seen on their hands and knees trying to stuff as many $1 bills into their clothing as possible before time runs out. Now, once again, if this was a teacher who was there trying to win $5,000 for their own use, I don't know if that's necessarily bad. The problem here was that the money was specifically for teachers to use in their classrooms. So it was basically, and right now South Dakota's got one of the least, is one of the lowest paying states for teacher wages. And teachers have to spend $350 or so of their own money for supplies in their classroom, of their own money. And so it was kind of one of those things where it was desperation. And so it became more freaking like the Hunger Games than some sort of competition where someone got, you're going to win a trip to Mazatlan, that sort of thing. So, and they apparently didn't see the difference before they did this, and they're idiots for that. Viewers called it disgusting, degrading, dehumanizing, and more, with Martin Luther King King's daughter, Bernice King, weighing in on the quote from her father. Also, many pointed to the figures showing South Dakota teachers among the worst paid in the country. The Stampede held the promotion in partnership with CU Mortgage Direct, which provided the money. Both have now apologized in a joint statement saying, although our intent was to provide a positive and fun experience for teachers by making them grovel for money. Wow. We can see how it appears to be degrading and insulting towards the participating teachers and the teaching profession as a whole. You think? Wow. Seriously. That, you guys need to run this past someone else before you do this. We deeply regret and apologize to all teachers for any embarrassment that this might have caused. They received 31 applications for the Dash for Cash and selected 10 participants, with each of the chosen teachers getting at least $500, the statement says. In addition, the team and CU Mortgage Director are more than doubling the initial donation amount. The 21 teachers that applied will each get $500, and the 10 that participated in the promotion will receive another $500 on top of what they grabbed on Saturday. That's $15,500 more than the initial $5,000 in cash scattered at ICE for the promotion. Moving forward, the Stampede and CU Mortgage Direct will continue to support the teachers and work with the South Dakota Teachers Association on future events. They'll provide funding for our next generation. The statement says CU Mortgage Direct and Stampede will have no firmer comment at the time. Because you guys, you're not the first businesses to do something like this. I mean, what was it? Well, was it the Pepsi people that had an ad that they tried to put out there about protesting and, you know, people protesting violence against police officers with, was it Caitlyn Jenner or something like that in there? And Saturday Night Live did a very good bit on that where they kind of say, you know, why didn't someone ask this question before? And so they pretended it was the director calling up family members and saying, well, I'm doing this ad where we're embracing this the culture of protesting police violence with Pepsi Cola and Caitlyn Jenner. And what do you mean I shouldn't do it? What do you mean that's a horrible idea? What do you mean that will blow up in my face? I don't know what you're talking about. So, you know, and sometimes I think sometimes the reaction is false. Like the time they went after the Peloton woman. You know, okay, she's you know, and as far as I saw a person that represented Peloton exactly like every person I know that's got a Peloton bike. But some people were upset with how, you know, it portrayed them. Whatever. Needless to say, you know, you have to run things past it. Sometimes you'll miss things, sometimes you don't. I think if you said, hey, what if we have teacher grovel for money they can use in their classrooms? Someone should have said, you know, that's a little dystopian, isn't it? That's a little Hunger Games future-like, isn't it? And, you know, they should have. Frankly, they should have done that. And so as much as they're running away from it at this time, they're running away from it because they realize that they screwed up by not having someone proofread the script in that case. Teachers don't deserve this. Teachers, dear Lord, I was just seeing the story of one of our teachers of the year has just retired because of the stress and the threats that they're getting from parents. It's inexcusable. We have a lot of hard workers that are out there. There are a lot of hard workers. And sure, the first thing people will always say is, oh, well, they'll say police and fire. And yeah, absolutely. A lot of police officers are very good police officers, very good people, and they work really hard. Same thing with fire departments. Ambulance drivers, they get paid crap. And there are a lot of outstanding ambulance drivers out there. Nurses and doctors, please. Angels on earth right there. Angels on freaking earth right now during this pandemic. I'll go with teachers in that category too. Desperately trying to figure out an education model which they never ever anticipated prior to a year and a half ago. Never anticipated. You have grocery store workers, janitors, people that were called into work as frontline workers when everyone else had the luxury of staying at home. A lot of people out there we should be thanking. A lot of people out there. And we should maybe, just maybe, and this is why I call this a righto story, is because it's so freaking South Dakota, isn't it? Just right-wing ideology on display. Make the teachers beg and grovel for classroom supplies. We need to do better. And one last quick thing here. If you're an amazing jackass that's thinking about threatening a teacher, shut up, you jerk.
Happy holidays.
952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. We'll take a break. Come on back. Rebecca Cook going to join us, running for Wisconsin 3's Democratic nomination. We'll talk with her when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. -54 degrees tomorrow on December 15th. Wow. Yeah, that's normal. nothing unusual there. Wow. 952-946-6205. Well, you know, with 2022 coming up here, we are going to restart up the Democrat of the Day series before too long, because we got a lot of races we got to talk about. Not only here in Minnesota, but also across the river, our friends in Wisconsin, too. Well, because there is a seat over there, Wisconsin 3, which needs to be held by the Democrats, I'm actually going to start it up a little early this year, because I'm going to have a lot of people that want to get in, you know, talk about their campaigns. And so it's an opportunity for you to hear about a candidate that's running for the Democratic nomination for to run in the Wisconsin 3. In Wisconsin 3. Rebecca Cook is kind enough to join us right now. She is deciding to run and hopefully can hold that seat for the Democrats. Hi, Rebecca. How are you today?
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me on.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you very much for coming on. We don't get a lot of Wisconsin politicians, but the reality is if you're on the, especially on the south side of town, it's probably closer to your district, the Wisconsin 3, than it is to, say, districts up in the northwest part of the metro.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, and there's a lot of folks that live in Wisconsin and work in Minnesota. So there's probably a lot of people that, you know, your coworkers that are just from over the border.
Well, I'm glad you reached out. I'm glad we're talking here. For everyone out there, we should make sure everyone understands. Representative Kind, I believe it is retiring. Mm-hmm. He decided that he's not going to run again.
Right. Exactly. So it's a wide open seat for the first time in 20 some years. Which is a pretty big deal in a district like this that's been held by a Democrat for a long time.
The district, to say it's gerrymandered, holy cow! they have tried their best to basically. I don't know if they're trying to put as many Democrats in one district so they can seal them off, or they're desperately trying to diffuse as much Democratic vote as possible. But that is a wild district that runs basically, like I said, right across the river in Wisconsin, the south east suburbs, all the way down to the border with Illinois.
Yeah, it's a pretty big district. I'm actually going over tonight to Stevens Point, which is, you know, kind of hooked up into central Wisconsin. So you go all the way over to Eau Claire, which is where I'm from. And hook over into the Stevens Point area. Yeah, and then all the way down the Mississippi River, down to Prairie du Chien. So, yeah, it's pretty wild.
I'm going to suggest to everyone that's listening right now, you're going to need to make a donation to Rebecca's campaign, because I'll tell you what, the driving alone, my goodness. You're going to be putting a lot of miles on the car.
I'm in the car right now. I'm in the car on the side of the road just making my way through the district, you know. So
there, we want to find out more about you. Who exactly is Rebecca Cook?
Yeah, so I grew up here in the Eau Claire area. I was born and raised, grew up on a dairy farm in Eau Claire, and was really active in 4-H growing up. So shout out to 4-H. Showed dairy cattle all through the years. But, you know, like a lot of Wisconsin family farms, we had to sell our cows because of the price of milk and competition with larger dairies. But growing up on a farm, you know, had a really big impact on me, both in the value set that I grew, but also just my work ethic and how to show up for people and show up for your neighbors. And so I actually went to school in the Twin Cities. I went to school at the University of St. Thomas. And worked at an affordable housing nonprofit all 4 years of school there with my work study. So I really got to know the Twin Cities Metro in a big way, coming from small town Eau Claire, you know, getting to walk in some different shoes in Minneapolis, St. Paul, which was great. And I think, you know, widened my perspective of the world and connecting with other people that, you know, that are different than me. So I went to school in the Twin Cities and worked on campaigns for a few years out of college, and then ultimately came back to Eau Claire to open my own small business. So I run a small business in my community downtown, and also launched a nonprofit organization that supports other women on that same path of entrepreneurship. So we award four $2,000 grants every spring and fall to women who want to start their own businesses throughout Western Wisconsin. So we help 27 small businesses launch throughout this district and community. Yeah, which is a big deal. I mean, in a small town, when we talk about how do you make change on the grassroots level and how do you show up in rural communities and reinvest in them, it's really important. And that work, earned me, Governor Evers appointed me to the Wisconsin Economic Development Corporation Board, or WEDC. So I've been able on the state level to really advocate for small businesses and farmers and rural communities in that capacity. So when the seat opened, I just really want to serve my community in an even greater way. So that's a little bit about
a few things here. First of all, 4-H is cool. My kids are in 4-H as well here in the metro area because I think it's nice. That is a great organization. And not only, I mean, they don't have to deal with the cows like you did, but at the same time, it's right. A great organization for understanding agriculture and horticulture. And it's just a lot of fun. They've always had a lot of fun with 4-H. So I can understand that.
Yeah, and it's really. Right, and it's really rooted in service, too, service to your community. So that's awesome.
Eau Claire is a lovely town. I've actually spent quite a bit of time over there because of my kids getting into honor bands, and we've gone over to the University of Wisconsin-Eau Claire. And so I've been there multiple times. That's an absolutely cute town that is the epitome of how do you revitalize a small town, change it, and keep it thriving.
Right.
Because that town is – there are a lot of communities that would look at something like Eau Claire and say, how are you doing it? And they have done a very good job of creating growth, creating business opportunities, and nurturing the local climate enough to where you do have an economic advantage over other communities. It's done a great job.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I think, we experienced an incredible, I would say, renaissance of sorts in our community. And a lot of people that grew up there choosing to come home and reinvest. There's a lot of great peers of mine and folks that really were devoted to, just increasing the overall quality of life of folks who live in Eau Claire and wanting it to be a livable city, not just for people that visit it, but for people who live there and making it a community that you want to raise your family in, and that is thriving. So, so it's great to be a part of, and that's why, coming back to my hometown, wanting to have a small business in our downtown and wanting to really lay roots there was really important to me, just because there was so much positive energy kind of coming out in that way. It's infectious and hard not to want to be a part of. So.
Rebecca Cook is joining us. She's running for Wisconsin 3 for the Democratic nomination to run in the general election over there. I want to bring up, of course, obviously your district is heavy in farming and heavy in dairy. Of course, there is this narrative the Republicans like to put out there that small farms are being killed off by the Democrats. That's ludicrous. Small farms are being killed off by corporate farming and the enablers that are the Republican Party that basically are looking at small farms. And Wisconsin, as you talk about the dairy industry, we've talked about it on this show. Mm-hmm. Wisconsin has actually been decimated. Their dairy industry has been decimated by the pricing, which then led to the opportunist of large corporate farms basically buying out farms, running farms out of town. Talk a little bit about this, because if we don't make a stand at some point, we're going to be down to 30 or 40 total corporate farms in this country, and there's not going to be really, and the small farm will disappear.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and it's something, I think for folks to remember, farmers were our original entrepreneur in many ways. When I think about the dairy industry, I don't just lump it into agriculture, right? It's a huge part of our commerce system and our base. And I think when people lose a business like a family farm, it's not just losing a business. Also, it's losing a way of life. And part of your heritage, our family had a farm in this district for 160 years. We pioneered here, in the 1800s to Buffalo County to start farming. And so when my dad had to sell our dairy cattle, it's not just, selling, something you've done for part of your life. It's selling so much more. It's part of your soul, right?
Yeah.
And having to pivot and figure out what's next. I mean, a lot of farmers have really been left to do that on their own. You see a lot of different agritourism ideas that people have really just come up with to make ends meet. You see a lot more dairy farmers starting to raise beef cattle, which is something my dad did to help supplement income. You know, we also milk three farms at once. We had our home farm, farm up the road, and another farm the other up, end up the road. And, you know, it's just, it's tough, and it's not margins that are easy. And we're leading a lot of people to figure it out on their own, which isn't, I don't think, where we want the kind of direction we want to be of losing these farms, but also figuring out what farmers are to do after they do lose their farm. There aren't a ton of options, right?
I would agree with that, and it's interesting because I'd love to find out what the margins are there, because in Minnesota it's much more grain farming, sugar beets, pork. Not saying that we don't have dairies. We have a lot of dairies here. But, I mean, the larger agriculture there, the margins on that, I believe, last time I checked was like $24,000, which is – and it's actually gone down in the last few years even. What do you know off the top of your head what the margins are for the standard dairy farm, the standard agricultural farm in Wisconsin?
No, I don't know that off the top of my head. Sorry.
Okay. Well, it's. I think it's because one of the things that's important about that is that it's if you're basically expecting people to work as hard as farmers do, dairy farmers do, that if they're only, you know, their reward at the end of the year is, you know, $23,000-$24,000, that's a system that's just not going to work. And this is as you talk about the foundation, the original entrepreneurs. This is the foundation of American, you know, efficiency. It's basically the ability for us to feed our own people. And if we basically get to a point where we're losing that, that's crippling.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
I want to ask you as well, your district, I imagine, goes into some fairly conservative areas. The DFL in the state of Minnesota, one of the things that I've run into with some DFLers is that they're a little hesitant because they say, oh, I'll go out there and they're threatening me and all these things. I said, they're threatening you because they're trying to scare you away. They're trying to do this. And I said, well, it's working. Well, it's like, but you see, that's all they have left. They don't have ideas. They don't have, you know, solutions. They're not looking out for their constituents. They're just trying to scare away the competition. You're going to get that. This is just the day and age we live in politics here. Talk a little bit about that and how you would address that as you're going around your district.
Yeah, you know, I haven't had come into anything in particularly like that, you know, as far as anybody, you know, trying to intimidate me, I guess, in particular ways. I have had a lot of, like, pragmatic conversations, to be honest, with Republicans around this district. I think that there is, like, you know, in both parties, there's fragments of, you know, the far left and the far right. And I think that not all Republicans are like the radical right, that, you know, my opponent certainly is, my Republican opponent is. I think there's a lot of Republicans that, you know, are pragmatic, that are John McCain Republicans, that want to see somebody that can work across the aisle and that can truly work in a bipartisan way. And that's a pragmatist and knows how to get things done. And that's the kind of leader I intend to be. I think we're getting so far into these camps of us versus them. And we need to move out of that kind of thought, that kind of thinking, and the chaos that I think has been stirred up, you know, through the Trump administration, and trickled through here. And I think, to me, you know, it's important, a lot of democratic values that I have, but it's also really important for me to be able to work with my neighbors. You don't see Congress getting a lot of things done because of the, you know, hyper-partisanship that exists. And we're getting to these moments, especially when there's so many threats to our democracy, where we really need to be working together, no matter if you're an R or a D.
I would agree with that. And I think that the real challenge here, and it's, I've always told people, it's like, hey, we're in a pandemic, medical bills, let's face it. Right now we have a lot of people sick. A lot of people tragically have died, but there's also a lot of people left behind with massive medical debt. And talking about that, and the fact that, you know, a lot of this is being instigated by people telling people not to get vaccinated, not to wear a mask. And it's the medical science tells us. I think that for Democrats going on out there and talking about it's not about what you want to hear politically. It's what's real. And I'm here for that. I think that that does resonate, that people don't want to have that, you know, a political spin, that everything is run through a political filter, whether it's healthcare or religion or whatever. They want honesty. And I think that especially in this crisis right now, I think if the Democrats go and hammer away on healthcare, we're the party that wants to do single payer. We want the party that wants to have affordable healthcare. We want to, you know, if you're not for single payer, if you're just for, you know, a better healthcare system, Democrats are for more access and more affordability, that's for sure, across the line. So I think you're exactly right. I think you have to find those ways. And I it will be interesting. I think we're starting to see that those moderate Republicans are just getting tired of getting further and further yanked to the right. I agree with you. I think they're looking for other options at this point.
Yeah, and I mean, I really intend to run a campaign in an office and on kitchen table issues. I think things that affect, you know, everyday Wisconsinites, everyday Americans, the things that people are worried about and staying up at night around, right? Like, mm-hmm. like you said, like access to affordable quality health care. Mm-hmm. My mom had a heart attack this summer and got a six-figure hospital bill. No. And, you know, if it wasn't on Medicare, I mean, she's a senior. I don't know how they would have afforded that. You know, I'm on catastrophic health insurance myself that I have through exchange as a small business owner. But it's not something that covers much, right? And so I think, you know, we have to rethink the way in which, you know, our healthcare system looks in America. We've got, you know, from a rural broadband perspective, when you think about people and access to marketplaces, access to telehealth, being in rural communities, kids doing their homework in Culver's parking lots, you know, that's a real big divide as far as, you know, rural and urban and being able to have access to some of those services and resources that help communities move and thrive and grow. And I think, you know, job creation and sustainable job creation, having job creators that really, again, want to invest in the community. You look at how great Eau Claire is doing as a community, and that's because of the business owners that have really chosen to invest in their employees. So you know, it's a lot of those basic things I think that folks worry about. And I think, too, you know, from an education perspective, ensuring that, you know, no matter what school district you're in, that you have the resources that you need in the classroom. So those are kind of the main pillars I would say that my campaign is and I'm really focused on, and that I think people are really worried about right now, to be honest, you know, in this like current pandemic world. I mean, we're not post-pandemic yet, right?
No, we're not. We're not.
Yeah. And just figuring out how to make ends meet in what is an economy that's, you know, up and down. So
Rebecca Cook,
a lot of different folks.
Rebecca Cook is once again running Wisconsin 3. If you'd like to donate or volunteer, once again, she's running for the Democratic nomination so she can run in the general election. You find out more information about her campaign at Cook. That's C-O-O-K-E, C-O-O-K-E, 4, F-O-R, Wisconsin, all spelt out, .com. C-O-O-K-E-F-O-R-W-I-S-C-O-N-S-I-N.com. And you can find out more information, make a donation, volunteer if you can. And once again, if you're in the Twin Cities metro area, Wisconsin 3 is right across the river. I mean, quite literally from the southeast suburbs, it's right there. It's closer to you if you're on the south side than any of the northern metro suburbs. So by all means, help the Democrats across the river as well and see if we can make sure we hold Wisconsin 3 for the Democrats. Rebecca, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much today.
Yeah, thank you. I appreciate it. Thanks a lot.
You bet. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Rebecca Cook, once again, running in Wisconsin 3. That is one gerrymandered district. Holy cow. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. One last story here before the end of the hour here. Another episode of racial profiling in the Gopher State. A black man was put in handcuffs at a local bank for alleged fraud when he tried to cash a $900 check, according to KSTP TV. Now, I did post this story online, but I have not talked about it online. The video was recorded in a police officer's body cam. Joe Murrow, a 23-year-old black man, was threatened to be arrested by police at the U.S. Bank in Columbia Heights, Minnesota, for fraud. Even though he had an account with the bank and previously showed his identification, it didn't matter. From KSTP-TV, the bank manager told officer he suspected the check was fake, but police body camera video shows he only called Morrow's employer for verification after the 23-year-old black man was removed from his office. And the check was, in fact, real. This guy basically said he's black, this can't be real, and that was the entire thing. The U.S. bank disputed Morrow's allegation in racial profiling, but quietly agreed for a confidential settlement 2 weeks later after five investigated, starting asking questions about the incident. Lawyers and advocates say Morrow's experience raises question about implicit bias and is part of the national phenomenon that more black Americans have been documenting in recent years with social media hashtag banking while black. When I'm coming out of the manager's office, I was handcuffed. People were looking like I'm a criminal or something. You are not a criminal, sir. The U.S. Bank even had to acknowledge the blatant racial profiling displayed by their employee and the local police who handcuffed Murrow. But as more details have come to the come out on the reasoning why Murrow was arrested, it becomes even more shocking, frustrating, and mind-boggling when he was even in handcuffs. Sergeant Justin Pletcher arrived first. His body camera recorded Murrow sitting in the bank manager's office, leaning back with his hands folded. John Asquith, the bank manager who called police, who, by the way, was blurred and muted in the video because he doesn't want any kind of publicity. Do you, John Asquith? Don't mind giving it to other people, but not you, I guess. In the first minute of the video, Murrow can be heard asserting his innocence. I work there, bro. I'm going to report it report you too, bro. This is racial, Murrow said with Asquith. The video does not appear to show Murrow raising his voice or using profanity, but his claim of racial profiling was immediately met with a warning. Joe, I need you to calm down, first of all, okay? Pletcher said, don't say anything stupid because you're just going to get arrested for it. Oh, you're going to get arrested for pointing out the reality that's going on in front of everyone's face. Minutes later, a second officer arrived. Police say the manager asked them to move Murrow to an adjacent office. The video then shows officers handcuffing Murrow after what he appeared to stand up quickly from his chair. In the incident report, Pletcher wrote that Murrow flexed at John Asquith with a threatening manner. Oh, I'd love to see how that is. You flexed at someone in a threatening manner, slapped the cuffs on him. Dude, have you gone to a Republican Trump rally lately? If that's your standard, you better bring about 5,000 pairs of cuffs. I didn't threaten him. I got up. I'm mad, Murrow said. The guy told the officer, you can get him out of my office. He might take something on my desk. That's when I got super mad. I'm going to touch something on your desk? KSTP interviewed the expert on the bias who calls the bank, and while blank is not unusual in the land of 10,000 lakes. That's just there is no excuse for this behavior. And shame on U.S. Bank for denying it initially. Shame on the officers for their behavior. The guy just wanted to cash his check. And they just presumed he's black. It's got to be fake. Shame on all of you. And frankly, all of you should be moving out of the state because you're the problem. You're not the solution. That's a fact. Come on back. Dina Winter from Minnesota Reformer when we do return. 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It's the Matt McNeil Show. Matt Patrick here. Usually on Tuesdays, Brett Johnson joins us. He's on vacation, enjoying a little bit of early holiday time off, which leads me to have to talk to the excellent people over at the Minnesota Reformer. Now, first of all, I'm going to just say this. If you're not reading the Minnesota Reformer every day, you're just wrong. You are just wrong. It is an absolutely must-stop news source for me every single day. Sign up, help support them as well. The exceptional Dina Winter is kind enough to join us to talk about covering the Potter trial. She's been watching that for the Minnesota Reformer. Dina, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
You're welcome. Thank you.
My pleasure. Today, let's talk a little bit about what happened today. You've been watching this trial. What was kind of the main focus on the testimony today?
Well, today it was a little more focused on the policies that they have out in Brooklyn Center and whether Kimberly Potter was following them correctly, you know, how to use your taser, what the policies are for firing into a vehicle if someone's trying to flee and so on. So I guess you may have heard that the judge at one point had the jurors stand up and stretch, and there was some speculation as to whether they were dozing off. And I wasn't in the courtroom today. I'm kind of listening with one ear, but the pool reporter for the day said that there was a juror dozing off. So that might give you an indication of how the testimony is being received today.
It's a little dry. Now I'm going to go out on a ledge here. There is nothing in the manuals for the police department up there that says, oh yeah, this is what you do, accidentally confuse your firearm, your service weapon as a taser and shoot for the heart. I'm going to imagine that the prosecutor's trying in their best to make, I'm presuming this is the prosecutor and they're talking about this at this point, but they're trying to make the argument that there's nothing here in these books that justifies anything that she's done.
No, I mean, but they did delve into whether it's okay to fire your weapon into a vehicle with someone. You know, some of the risks associated with that, because of course the defense is saying, you know, getting people, witnesses to say that actually that deadly force would have been justifiable. So they're kind of delving into some of that.
Well, let's, if you don't mind, let's go back to that a little bit, because the way that I've read and followed this as well, I'm not there either, but I mean, it's the way I've read and followed this too. It's this if he would have taken off, if he would have been dragging the officer, if he would have gotten hurt, if it was dangerous, then okay, this was justified. Which even here's the problem that they had is that the former supervisor for her that basically was trying to create this excuse for Kim Potter to shoot, that there was going to be something that happened. He, at the end of his testimony, had to admit, well, no, Dante Wright hadn't left the scene at the time he was shot. You know, it was pure speculation that was going to happen. So it's going to be one of those things where if you get a person who is, you know, unapologetically pro-police, that might resonate. But the reality is I think that even with what the defense is trying to do, it's a bit of a hard sell, because it's got to go with that. If this would have happened, if then this would have happened, if then this would have happened, no, then it would have been deadly force justified. And it doesn't seem like that they have that argument there. I've not seen more than one person, though, say that she has had the justification to shoot in this case. Has there been more?
I think there have been two now.
Okay.
I do believe there have been two, because by my count. So there was one. I know there was one Friday when I was in the courtroom, and then I believe there's been another one since. And then there was a motion by the prosecution to limit them from saying that, basically. So, but they were denied on that. So.
Well, it's purely speculative. It's interesting that they're allowing that, because once again, it's like saying, if I'm on the defendant, would you be able to say, and if it was a robbery case, well, if this TV had actually fallen out in the sidewalk and not been in the store, and if I would have picked it up then, well, it was basically been mine. I was just picking finders keepers, so they should give it to me, and no one would follow that argument. I mean, when you get into the speculative nature sometimes, and I don't understand the law sometimes, I really don't, but it would seem to me that if you have to put about six ifs in front of a statement to justify the actions that actually did happen, I don't know if you've got a solid case. That's just me, though. That's just me.
Well, but I did talk to a former prosecutor today who he's written that he doesn't think the case is winnable, because there have been several Supreme Court decisions that would buttress saying that it is okay to shoot at a suspect trying to evade arrest in a car, basically. And he thinks that even if she... that it would get thrown out on appeal, basically.
Yeah.
That's what he thinks. But so it's kind of interesting, you know. That's, I suppose, why they're really focusing on that issue, is, you know, the shooting at someone fleeing. So.
Yeah. It's one of those rulings, and I say it, and I don't and this is me saying it. This is not you saying it. This is me saying it. It's one of those rulings that is basically say, yeah, well, black people, when stuff like this happens, we need to basically make sure there's cover, because the reality is that it's inexcusable that when you have in Dante Wright's case, he didn't commit any serious felonies. He was basically, there was a warrant out for his arrest, an air freshener hanging down. That's not the last time I checked, that shouldn't be an instantaneous death penalty, handed out by an officer who can't figure out whether she's got her taser or her gun in her hand. And so I think that that's the argument. And by the way, if I can bring that up.
Absolutely. And that prosecutor agrees with that, with you on that. That is, yeah, no, that's not how we, it's a tragedy all around.
Well, and as I brought that up, one of the things that's interesting is, can you counter that argument, the eventual appeal, if that's where this goes? With the argument, well, she herself has admitted she grabbed the wrong weapon. She didn't grab a taser.
Yeah.
She grabbed her service weapon. Does she herself, by her own acknowledgement in the body cam videos, negate any potential for saying, well, yeah, if she would have just intentionally drawn the weapon, is that a better appeal than her admission that I thought I had the taser?
Well, that's for an attorney to say.
Yeah,
I don't know.
That's more just me thinking off the head. But that's an interesting one. I love your story, by the way, Dina. I want to, speaking of the taser and the gun, I love the, your story where you showed the differences between the service weapon and the taser. And the reason why is that there were a lot of defenders of Kim Potter prior to the trial. Not saying that they were associated with the defense, but people that were out there clearly trying to make an argument for Kim Potter that she didn't do anything wrong, that did not have that taser. They had a black taser that looked very similar to the service weapon. They said, see, it'd be easy to screw up. Well, no, that wasn't the taser they used. And when you look at the picture that's associated with your article, and once again, go to the Minnesota Reformer and see this. I highly encourage it. You look at this as like, she confused those two? Because I can also tell you this, as a person that was in the military and fired a pistol, you put a magazine, a loaded magazine, into a pistol, that's going to weigh a ton more than a taser.
Yeah, they said twice as much.
Yeah.
I mean, when loaded, they said in court when I was there yesterday. So, I mean, it's interesting because, and I've tried in my mind, tried to think of how, you know, that might happen too. And I'm thinking, well, how often are they doing shooting practice and all that? You know what I mean? They're just that rote memory, whatever, you know, that, I don't know. I don't have the answer to that, but I'm sure we'll hear from her on that issue.
Well, and
how did you do that? How could you do that?
It is interesting. I mean, I will say this. It, clearly, from the body cam footage, she clearly was showing remorse for her actions. She clearly was in to a point where even the other officers had removed her service weapon and taken the bullets out of the one that they put back into her holster as a way to basically prevent her from possibly hurting herself. But at the same time, I mean, we have to have. If we have a factory collapse because a person who's unqualified to be on a forklift drives into a foundation structure and then knocks the whole thing down and people are killed, well, the person that was driving the forklift, it might be an accident, but they're still responsible for the action. And I think this is where it's an interesting thing is, do we really have where that's not an option for the police, that the police can really screw up on a magnitude where there's a dead person at the end of the day and there aren't any consequences?
Well, this prosecutor I was mentioning was saying, he wrote in an article that they should really, you got to go talk to the legislature about creating maybe some type of sanctions for that sort of thing. Because he thinks they're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole, you know, with this case. So there you go.
Well, I that's interesting, too. Once again, pure speculation on what happened to the case. If Potter is found to be innocent, I guarantee you there's going to be a push in St. Paul to pass a piece of legislation that says if you accidentally shoot someone with a gun instead of a taser, you do not have, you know, qualified immunity. I have zero doubt the Republicans will block it. You know, my God, they wouldn't even, you know, prevent from, you know, white supremacists from becoming cops, for goodness sakes. So, you know, I have zero doubt the Republicans would block it, but I think they'll at least be this idea that that's got to be something. You can't have people making that level life or death mistakes in a position of power like that.
Yeah. So we'll see.
All right.
Guess we'll see what happens with this one.
And a little bit more here. And once again, Dina Winter joining us from Minnesota Reformer on this case. Do you feel as a person that's paying more attention to this, do you feel that the defense is making the argument as you watch this? Obviously the prosecution team has their game plan. The defense team has their game plan. As far as you've seen here, who do you think is making the better argument at this point?
Well, that's a tough one for a reporter. I mean, you sort of sit there and think. I was thinking to myself, you know, gosh, the reporter would tell the story and stick, you know, get to the point and kind of stick to it. And these things just they have to do the whole dragging things out with chain of custody and all this other stuff that just tends to get. And I thought, well, that's just me because I'm a journalist and I don't know how you convict a person. But, you know, like this prosecutor was telling me today that he feels like they're putting on a lot of evidence and dragging things out, too, that, a lot of evidence is not in dispute by the defense. And so it's not really clear why they're spending so much time on it. He feels like to try to make it look like they have more evidence than they do, but I don't know. I have I'm not sure who's winning, and I think it's really impossible to say when it comes to juries. But
yeah,
was his take on it, and I kind of felt like too, like it's, you know, you've got jurors falling asleep at this point.
Well, the 2 points. First of all, it is not fair for me to answer because you are a journalist and you are a very good journalist, and journalists do tell the story. They don't get in there. Apologies for that. I shouldn't have asked you that question. And you're right. You can say, well, it looks overwhelmingly like this person is destroying the person, but then the jury comes back on the other side. How many times has that happened? It has a lot.
Yeah.
So I guess it wasn't a fair question to ask, but I will say this. Your observation, the fact that it's interesting that they are trying to lay out so much information. Putting it back on the Chauvin trial and the way that they, you know, meticulously laid out that case. And there it seemed like, though, what you had was witnesses that brought bang for the buck. And as much as the defense, and wasn't exactly the greatest defense lawyer of all time, but the way the defense tried to charge that, he just kept getting knocked down because the prosecution's witnesses were that good. But in this case, it seems different because, like I said, when you're having to have the jury stand up to stretch and not yawn or fall asleep, your presentation is lacking in pizzazz. How about we put it that way?
Well, I've covered a few trials in my time, but I've never seen. I was a little bit shocked to see her do that because, you know, she just interrupted the prosecutor like in the middle of his questioning of a wit, you know, to do that, and so. And so everybody was like, well, something must have been going on there. Like, was someone sleeping or what? So with the Chauvin case, you had, you know, the police chief get up on the stand and say, this was wrong. And other police employees in this case, they're having to come and testify against their former coworker too, but you're not getting these adamant, you know, declarations like you did with the Chauvin case. So it is, they're saying, you know, several have admitted, you know, they know her, they like her, or, you know, even a BCA agent, her husband was friends with her husband. I mean, these BCA agents are often former cops in, you know, smaller towns or mid-sized towns, and so they're so interwoven, you know, and so, but it's, you're not having those witnesses like you did in Chauvin's that are coming right out and saying this was wrong.
Well, in Chauvin too, it was. The defense tried the if sort of thing, where you know, if this was a case, if this was this. Oh, thank God they did what they did, and it just fell flat because. I think that the prosecution team there had just better witnesses. They were prepared for those arguments. It just doesn't seem like the prosecution team in this one is as prepared for that argument because the reality is, I mean, I'm not a lawyer. But the first thing I said is, well, if they're going to go use the if, I would have stood up and said, if she would have grabbed her taser, would Dante Wright be alive right now? And that's a tough question for that officer who's backing her up to have to answer. You know, I can do it too. And so it's interesting. I don't know if they've released a witness list for the prosecution, but is there any hint at how long they're going to be still working their side of the case?
People are kind of expecting them to maybe wrap up as soon as tomorrow. So. Okay. So they were hoping, the judge was hoping to have it wrapped up before Christmas, and it sure, unless this defense has just got a, we have the lists of witnesses, but I think we'll see. I mean, I don't know how many witnesses they will call, but I think it's going to be wrapping up. Well, probably much sooner than we expected.
I will say this: if they feel like they've already made their argument, they'll bring Potter to the stand and be done with it. I mean, if the defense team is confident, you'll see a very quick, you know, maybe 2 days for them, and they're done, and then they'll send it to the jury. We'll have to see it like that. But like I said, it's all speculation at this point. So you know, speculation is the pure enemy of great journalism. Minnesota Reformer, once again, it is. I'm a trained chimp. I just come here and babble. You guys are the journalists, and you do a great job. Ricardo Lopez, yourself. all of you are just fantastic. If you're looking for the best news in town right now, it's Minnesota Reformer, hands down. Hands down, MinnesotaReformer.com. And make sure you donate and keep them going, because we need journalism like this, not speculation like this chimp. Dina, thank you very much. You're going to have a new article on this trial coming out a little bit later on?
Yeah, I'm working on it.
All right. When it does come on.
Secret, but thank you very much for your very kind compliments.
Well, when that article does come on out, I'll make sure I get it posted on social media so people can read about it. Dina Winter from the Minnesota Reformer. Dina, thank you very much. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Take care. We'll take a break. Come on back. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Thanks, Dina Winter. And it isn't fair. I guess she's a great journalist. I shouldn't kind of ask her to speculate. But the reality is my observation from the Potter trial is I'm starting to get concerned that she is going to walk free and that there's not going to be any consequences. I mean, I'm sure that she's already stashed all of her money away. So basically that if she loses when the eventual loss in the civil trial happens, that basically she's ensured that that family gets no dime of hers. Meanwhile, the city of Brooklyn Center will basically have to write out a few million-dollar check. So, you know, you kind of get the, you know, you can kind of see where this is going. But I got to tell you the truth. I'm a little concerned about the prosecution because, like I said, when their chief came on in and he's like, if, then it would have been justified. Well, okay, if the judge is going to allow that level of speculation, the first thing you do is you stand up and it's like on cross, and say, hey, by the way, if she would have drawn her taser, would he still be alive? And you're like, yep, he would, because he can't argue that. And there seems to be some missed opportunities there. And frankly, too, if the story is as Dina described, if people are falling asleep during the prosecution's presentation, I mean, come on, what are you guys doing? You know, this is... You can go through there and question policy and procedure of what was going on without basically boring the freaking world to where your jury is falling asleep. It really is. I've said on this show many times, the way that the Republicans in the state have written the laws is that you could be an officer that could be drunk, off duty, drunk as a skunk in a bar, say to another guy in the bar, I gotta shoot you. Get in your car, drive drunk home, get your weapon, drive drunk back to the bar, and shoot the person. And all you have to do is say at the very last second, I was scared. And you can say, hey, yeah, up until this point I had it. Then I wasn't going to do it, but I saw his hand move, and now I had to defend myself. And quite literally, I'd say there's a 50-50 chance in that scenario that officer is going to walk free. And that they basically almost have they're almost legally can commit murder in the state of Minnesota. But this is different. I mean, this is an officer who we have on tape acknowledging she made a mistake. And once again, go take a look at the pictures. I have fired a service weapon when I was in the military, a pistol, hand pistol, that was loaded. It weighs a lot. It's got a lot of kick. It has a very different feel than a taser. And there, it's almost comical that this person would think that they had a taser in their hand when they had a loaded firearm in their hand. She has clearly admitted her mistake. So here you have a case where you have someone saying, I failed my job on the most basic level. I pulled a weapon when I shouldn't have, and I shot somebody with one bullet, and it killed them nearly instantly because it went right through their heart. That person was just not going to survive. And we have tape of her saying, oh, yeah, I screwed up. Oh, I made a mistake. Oh, my gosh, I murdered somebody. We have tape. We have her on record saying this. And if she's found not guilty, then tell me at what point we are actually holding police officers accountable for their behavior. Think about this. You murdered somebody because, and I'm not denying the fact that she thinks she basically had her taser in her hand. I'll also point out that makes you wildly incompetent. But still, for some reason, you are a police officer. You are wildly incompetent. You grabbed the wrong weapon and you fired the gun instead of the taser. And you admitted it. And the court system basically says, no blood, no foul. Well, there was tons of blood, but still no foul. You can't have a functioning society that works like this. And I'll go back to the earlier story where we were talking about black while banking while black, rather, and point out the fact that you can't have a case where that level of racism happened. I'll go back to the Stallings case where you can't have that level of incompetency happening and think that at any point you're going to be able to get credibility. The system needs to change, and it doesn't need to change dramatically. It just is. You have to start treating African Americans as human freaking beings. You have to start treating African Americans the same way you would treat a white. Because let's be honest, if Dante Wright was white, he would not be dead right now. He wouldn't. I highly doubt he would have ever been pulled over. And even if it was pulled over, they would say, well, you need to go check in with the courts because there's apparently a warrant out for your arrest. Have a good day there, fella. And they would have smacked the back of the car as he took off. We are light years away from being able to actually say we treat African Americans and Native Americans and Hispanic Americans and Asian Americans the same way we treat white Americans. And yet here we are as this case goes on out, and you're like saying to yourself, how in the world do you have an officer who freely admits, yep, grabbed the wrong service weapon, murdered a guy. No, not guilty? Okay, thank you very much. Then at that point, I think we have to give up the ghost that there is such thing as justice and integrity in policing anymore. Because eventually, when the next time a black person gets gunned down for unjustifiable reasons, the courts will find them innocent. They'll find them innocent. They'll be home for Christmas and they'll be able to open up all their gifts and have a great time and say, "Woo! Thank God you didn't get caught. You know that Dante Wright deserved it." No, he didn't. And that's the real crime here. I have zero doubt most of her supporters have completely, totally said Dante Wright deserved it. No, he didn't deserve an instantaneous death sentence handed out by Kimberly Potter. He did not. And in the same way is that the old guy that lives next to you, the old white guy that lives next to you, doesn't deserve to get gunned down by a cop. Stop it. She's incompetent. She should be held accountable. And yet, right now, I don't feel nearly as confident in this case as I was feeling with the Chauvin case. And even with Chauvin, I was still concerned about what was going to happen. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205. Let's take a break. Come on back. Minnesota coronavirus update when we do return. Reminder, Native Roots Radio coming up here at 6 o'clock tonight. Robert Pilot and crew. Ogama as well. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. Once again, thank you very much to Todd Colad for sponsoring AM 950 this week. You can, too. Call 952-946-8885, 952-946-8885, and find out how you can support the station that way. Basically, he's got a band, Just Folk. They've got their last song. This is going to be Todd's retiring here from music. Everywhere You Look, that's the last song. They put a video out with it. It features Jesse King. It's up. I've got a link on social media. Go check that out. Todd, thank you very much. 952-946-6205. 952-946-6205 is the phone number. The Minnesota coronavirus update for today. Tuesday's COVID-19 update from the Minnesota Department of Health includes 9,042 newly reported cases, 46 newly reported deaths. Now, once again, that's for the three-day period. It's Tuesday. It's a three-day period, the weekend, and I think it's Friday and the weekend. The state's COVID-19 death toll now is 9,964. The figures on Tuesday relate to the 72-hour period ending at 4 a.m. on Monday. So, yeah, it's Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. Minnesota's test positivity rate on the seven-day rolling average through December 6th is 10.6, which is down dramatically from the 11.9 it was at the other day. It still is way above where it should be. Anything over 10% puts Minnesota on the high-risk threshold for community transmission of the coronavirus. I want to remind people, we were down about 1% in late spring. This entire catastrophe has been caused by Republicans encouraging their supporters to not get vaccinated and not wear masks. And when they say, well, I never said that, you basically go out there and badmouth vaccines. You badmouth Joe Biden's attempts to try to save people. You badmouth wearing masks as face diapers. No, you guys have done your part. You guys have, this is bravo. Take a bow. You have convinced people that their political choices are more important than their own personal health. You guys should be chanting this. This should be the top of your freaking resume. You should be very proud of the work that you guys have done. Don't act as if this was something that you never intended. This is exactly what you wanted. And you've got a bunch of lemmings there that support you, that basically say, yeah, I need to die to show my support for the Republican Party. Congratulations. I'm trying to save these human beings' life, you know, the Christian way. You guys were out there basically saying, no, no, die, die, die. And I'm tired of you guys. Just tired of it. But don't deny what you have done. Don't deny what you have done. This is by design. You should be patting yourselves on the back and taking accolades. Yep, this death count, this sickness, this pandemic out of control in the state, courtesy of the Republican Party of Minnesota. Nice job, you fools. Through December 13th, the number of people with COVID and hospitalized in Minnesota was 1,636, down from 1,678 reported on December 10th. Of those hospitalized, 358 people are in intensive care, up from 348, and 1,284 are in non-ICU care, down from 1,335. There are currently only 21 staff adult ICU beds available in the entire state, up from the 13 as of December 10th. And 15 pediatric ICU beds available, which is up from 7 on December 10th. As of December 12th, the state reported that 3,701,044 people have received at least one dose of the COVID-19 vaccine, while 3,459,000 people have completed the vaccine series. The state has administered 1,418,056 third-dose booster shots. According to the CDC, which cites data from September 2021, an unvaccinated person was 5.8 times more likely to get COVID-19 and 14 times more likely to die from COVID than someone who is fully vaccinated. So, and all you have to do, I mean, people say, oh, it's not fair to bring the Republicans in this. Seriously, go out to rural Minnesota. Go out to these town halls. Go out and see these Republican politicians talking to the masses. All you need to do is find one person who says, yep, I didn't get vaccinated because the Republicans told me not to. You don't think that you're going to be able to find that? Please. According to the CDC, which cites data from September 2021, an unvaccinated person was 5.8 times more likely to get COVID. 5.8 times. 14 times more likely to die. For the life of me, Republicans, I don't know at this point why you're not frantically out in your districts screaming about get vaccinated, for goodness sakes. Total amount of cases in Minnesota, 969,450. Just sad. After Sunday's full-page newspaper ad from Healthcare Systems expressed the dire situation in Minnesota hospitals, the rallying cry to get more Minnesotans vaccinated to combat the coronavirus continues, with healthcare leaders trying to paint the grim picture seen in emergency rooms and intensive care units on a daily basis. Hey, Republicans, you did this, huh? Jennifer DeCubulis, CEO of Hennepin Healthcare, said Monday that there were more than 200 people waiting in emergency rooms around the state because there aren't enough beds and staff to provide the level of care that they need. And this is not, I mean, as far as the word hope goes, this is, I would hope that they're not sitting out in the patient waiting area. I would hope they're actually in the emergency room in one of the beds in the emergency room. But I don't know. And I have zero doubt there are probably people that are coming into emergency rooms in this state who are walking in there saying, you can wait. We need a bed to open before we can put anyone in there. Wow. Today, we literally had on our statewide report zero ICU beds available. Not only non-ICU beds, but over 200 individuals that needed a high level of care are boarding in our emergency departments, DeCubulus said. And that means we're delaying the acute response that individuals need. We're trying to get Minnesotans' attention to say this is dire. We need everyone's help, and it will take all of us from doing our part right now. The situation is grim despite the Department of Defense and other federal organizations sending medical teams to assist at Minnesota hospitals, including Hennepin Healthcare, St. Cloud Hospital, and Minnesota Health Fairview Southdale Hospital. Bringing these resources isn't going to solve it, but it's going to help us hold on a little bit longer, said DeCubulus. Dr. David Hilden, Vice President of the Medical Affairs at Hennepin Healthcare, also joined in saying, we're not doing business as usual in our healthcare systems, adding that the situation is preventable if people get vaccinated, get their COVID-19 booster dose, and when eligible, and wear a mask in public. So basically, what the healthcare industry is saying is, get vaccinated, get your booster, wear a mask. So anyone who downplays getting vaccinated, getting a booster, and wearing a mask, or even actually insist you shouldn't do that, well, whose side are they on? Death or living? Approximately 62% of Minnesota's population is fully vaccinated, and more than 1.3 million Minnesotans have received a booster dose of the COVID-19 vaccine. And while breakthrough cases are possible, the vast majority of people who wind up hospitalized with COVID-19 are unvaccinated. The vaccine has proved to be very effective at preventing severe illness and death. Once again, the vaccine has proven to be effective at preventing severe illness and death. Don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. I don't want you bankrupt. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. I don't want you bankrupt. I am begging you. I am yelling. I am screaming. I am begging you to get vaccinated. Not because it's some sort of political win for me, because I don't want you dead, you fools. I don't want you dead. I don't want you like all these people who are in ICUs or like, I think I should have gotten vaccinated. Really? I mean, there's a few just lunkheads who will go through an ICU and, you know, barely survive and come back out and say, still not going to get vaccinated. Pfft, really? Really? But most people, you know, it's the knocking on death's door, God willing they survive an ICU visit with COVID. It seems to be there. And you would think, okay, if you're just, you're not going to, you put your own health out there. My God, we talked about this a few weeks back. The average healthcare cost of a hospital stay, not a stay, is $45,000 for a hospital stay. If you have to have a ventilator or an ICU, it's up to $150,000. How many people, especially out in rural Minnesota, have that kind of money just lying around ready to go? How many? How many of them actually have Medicaid, Medicare, and are getting helped, but talk about how I'm never going to take government aid? Oh, please. The irony of it all, isn't it? It's very uncommon for vaccinated people to be deathly ill with COVID, says Hilden. Let me repeat that. I think that's worth noting. It's very uncommon for vaccinated people to be deathly ill with COVID, said Hilden. The vast majority of COVID patients in the ICU are unvaccinated. They're younger as well. We're seeing younger people, not older adults, adults in their 30s, 40s, and 50s on life support systems with COVID. They're almost all unvaccinated. Hilden's message was echoed by HealthCartner CEO Andrea Walsh. They've experienced an incredible increase in the number of 30 to 50-year-olds who are hospitalized and end up on ventilators because of COVID. There is only one adult ICU bed available in the entire Twin Cities metro region, according to state data. One in the entire Twin Cities. Hello, Minneapolis, St. Paul. One person can have a stroke. One person could have a heart attack. One person could get into a car accident. One person could have a serious fall, trying to hang up some Christmas lights and fall. One person. One. I don't know how you, I don't know, how did you guys get this broken? How did you ever, I get it, maybe I'm burying the lead. The fact that you guys daily ingest right-wing radio, right-wing newspapers, right-wing television, and that's all you get. But you would think to yourself that when the bubble pops and you're basically put into an ICU unit on a ventilator because you basically decided to grab ivermectin and jam it up your backside as opposed to getting vaccinated, and you realize, well, I guess that's not working. You would think that this would wake you up, that you would be out there in your community begging your neighbors, begging your community to get vaccinated. Nope, it's almost like it's a scarlet letter of shame. The scarlet letter C, and you wear it on your chest, and you go back home and you just hide in your house. And I better not go out there and tell people to get vaccinated, because if I do, they're all big Trump fans. They're going to get mad at me. I don't know what you do. I don't know what you do anymore. I'm not going to change. I'm going to repeat what I've been saying. I don't want you dead. I do not want the most far-right loon ball in this state dead. I don't. I'll disagree with you. I don't want you dead. I don't want you sick. Not this. Dear Lord, I've seen people sick with this. No. I don't want you sick. I don't want you dead. And frankly, I don't want you bankrupt for the rest of your life. Sitting there in 30 years, still scratching out $25 checks every month to pay for the medical treatments you got 40 years earlier. I'll stand by it. By the way, I should mention, Patrick, you're going to be upset about this. The Wild game against Carolina canceled tonight at the XL Energy Center. It's been postponed. The Hurricanes, Carolina Hurricanes, who left two players in Vancouver on Monday. I'll tell you what, Vancouver's a great town. Have you ever been up there? If I could, can you leave me in Vancouver for a few days? Oh, wait, they had COVID. They entered COVID-19 protocols, had four players test positive this morning at the X. Oh, God. The Hurricanes said the players were former Wild defenseman Ian Cole, Steven Lorenz, Jordan Stahl, and Andrei Shevchenkov. Is that how you say it? Shevchenkov?
Not sure.
Okay. There's a whole bunch of consonants together in that one. Andre, you're out. Forward Sebastian Aho and Seth Jarvis entered the NHL's COVID protocols on Monday because the roster was limited by salary cap issues. The Hurricanes have only had 13 available players for tonight. So they would have had, what, two lines? Two lines and one guy that goes out by himself. Yay! Well, and wait, they got two goalies. You got two goalies. I mean, you put both goalies in there in the net. I mean, it's going to be hard to score. You can have only like three guys on the ice at that point.
Could make one of them a skater, too, if you want.
He's got a lot of padding. He can ram into people. This is not only here. What was it yesterday? The LA Rams. They had like 10 of their players are now on COVID protocol.
Yeah, Rams actually shut down their training facility today because they had a number of positives. Vikings had a couple of positives in the last day or two as well.
I don't believe that. There haven't been any positives with that damn team for years. Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm here all week. Tip your waiters and waitresses.
You're lucky I don't have a sound effect on my soundboard for that.
Wah, wah. 952-946-6205. It's almost like someone said, hey, at Thanksgiving, be careful or else we're going to have a major... never mind. 952-946-6205. Last segment when we do return. It's the Matt McNeil Show right here on AM 950. AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. It is the Matt McNeil Show. From Bluestem Prairie, the usual suspects were back flogging their tales of election fraud, this time in sunny, beautiful Brainerd, Minnesota. last Thursday, and Minnesota District 12 State Senator Tori Westrum was in the audience. The Brainerd Dispatch, Tom Spire reports the event outlining 2020 election fraud claims encourages local involvement. About 300 people from across the state and country. Okay, that's even worse. Okay, we need to step back for a quick second. 300 people. 300 people. One of the biggest damn problems we've got in this state right now is we've got news media, not Minnesota Reformer, thanks Dina Winter, but a lot of news media that basically they have everything fire. Everything has to be, they've got a point and they've got a point. If they're going to say about 300 people in a state of 5.6 million showed up for a rally. Oh, you're like, why are we covering this? It's 300 people. 300 people out of a state of 5.6 million. But yet, this gets covered like it's, this is the opposing viewpoint. It's a bunch of fringe loon balls and Senator Tori Westrum. Yeah. I guess we could loop them together. But it's not exactly mainstream. So, and this is just the latest example of evidence. This is 300 people on a, this was that last Thursday in Brainerd, 300 people. There are 300, that's all you could get out of Brainerd? Wow. It's not a popular mentality, this far-right loonballism. They were there to discuss the 2020 election in Minnesota. Once again, if you want to challenge the election, here's the funny thing about Minnesota. We have paper ballots, you idiots. The machines only count the ballots. We have them all. If you want, you can just get them all and hand count them. And you got paper ballots. You can do this at any point. What fraud are you talking about? If you think there was a fraud, pay for the recount. We've got it. The Secretary of State's got all the ballots. You can just sit there and one, two. You just got to keep track. I mean, you don't want to lose concentration there. But you've got all the ballots. What fraud are you talking about? Because if there was fraud, all you had to do is do a recount and say, see, there's fraud. But you guys don't want a recount. Oh, that's right. You're just trying to gin up a little bit of anger issues. I get it. In attendance and applauding the claims made by the presenters were both current and former state representatives who echoed the crowd's sentiment. Minnesota State Senator Tori Westrum, a Republican who won his District 12 seat in 2020 election, and former U.S. Representative Jason Lewis, who lost his 2020 bid to unseat Democratic Senator Tina Smith, were both in attendance. Westrum declined an interview request. Oh, boo-boo kitty doesn't like the press. Boo-boo kitty. While we're curious about which current and former state representatives were in attendance, the speakers, Senator Westrum believed, were worth a four-hour round trip from the to and from Brainerd, more or less. Pastor Ben Davis, I'll tell you what, I'll post the picture, the story up here. It's from Bluestem Prairie. There's just a whole crew of people there. I should take a moment, if I can, with Tori Westrum. This was the guy that was trying to strip food stamps out of farmers markets, where we fed hungry people by giving the local farmers an opportunity to get paid for their product. I know what a great and positive program. But needless to say, Tori Westrum, who didn't seem to understand the concept of how the entire project worked, was trying to stop it, which makes him an idiot. It does. It does. And sure as heck makes you very non-Christian. And trust me, Tori, I have no problem calling you that. Because, dude, anyone that's trying to yank food out of hungry people's mouths, yeah, you're not. Does your Bible have the Gospel of Matthew in there? You might want to check that out. It's a read. Oh, my gosh. It's like liberal heaven. Gospel of Matthew. Jesus. You should read that. You know, his birthday's coming up. Oh, never mind. I don't want to spoil it for you. Needless to say, 300, three full hundred people showed up there. Oh, yeah. We're coming. We're coming. We're back tomorrow. Native Roots Radio up next. Till tomorrow. See ya.